Bear Radio.
Hello and welcome to the October edition of Ursa. We're Jill and Julia.
I'm Jill.
And I'm Julia. And it's winter, at least that's what it looks like. I don't know what happened to autumn. It just kind of went summer to misery.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I am being a true Berliner about this and starting this whole conversation by talking about the weather. But seriously, what is this?
It's like too cold, but then you put on 14 layers and then it's too hot.
Just, I can never win. We were on a call the other day with somebody and I had the same conversation and that person was like, yeah, but it's Berlin, you know that. And
I'm not used to it.
I felt very shut down. We should be. You've been here for a long time. Anyway, I'm headed off to Cape Town tomorrow. Jill, you are currently in Spain when this episode comes out. So we're fickle creatures. We bitch about it and then we leave.
Bye. But back to the episode. This month, our first feature story comes from a Bear Radio School alumna, Milica Tekeleva, where she explores an epic monument high on a peak in the Balkan Mountains in her home country of Bulgaria.
Then we hear from a podcast that has long been a Bear Radio favorite, Life of Bi, and we're so glad we get to share a segment of their second season with you. The episode is called Feral Girl Summer, and it's about bisexuality and non-monogamy. The segment you're going to hear explores the question, can you be bisexual and monogamous?
Then, you guessed it, our foodie of foodies, Jane Silver, is back. She tells us all about the concept restaurant that has taken over Berlin, as well as our Instagram feeds, and a top tip on the only place to find a superbly unique Turkish street food.
I wonder what it could be. Then we speak to Mr. Johnny Tiernan of Lola Magazine about a series of photographic exhibitions, Queerness in Photography. Also, the returning Festival of Lights, various club nights for you to party at, a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy-inspired festival, and a whole lot more.
We'll close out the episode with a piece from local musician and composer Andreas Miranda.
But first, the news. Jill, you got that sting lying around somewhere?
It's in my pocket. For my news story, I'm taking us to Italy, where Giorgia Meloni, as of recording, has claimed victory in the country's general election. She will be the sixth prime minister in just 8 years.
Doesn't seem like a good thing.
No. Now, Meloni is set to lead the most far-right government since the fascist era of Benito Mussolini.
Oh, yay.
Who she openly admires.
Even more yay.
She's even used his same motto for her own campaign. God, fatherland, family. Triple threat.
Woo.
The Brothers of Italy party was co-founded
That's
by...
That's their name?
Girl, yeah. The Brothers of Italy party was co-founded by Meloni in 2012, and the main platforms that they have revolve around Euroscepticism and anti-immigration policies. They formed to carry on the legacy and vision of Italy's extreme right, which dates back to the Italian social movement. That was the party that formed after the National Fascist Party was banned after World War II for some reasons. In the words of Ignazio La Russa, Meloni's predecessor as the head of the Brothers of Italy, we are all heirs of Il Duce.
Who's that?
That was what Mussolini called himself, like how Hitler called himself the Führer.
Oh, great. Okay.
She once said in an interview, I think Mussolini was a good politician. Everything he did for Italy. In the last election in 2018, the party won only 4.5% of the vote, but it has become quite popular since then, along with other anti-establishment parties such as the Five Star Movement and The League, which I always just think of that show. Anyways, there's a show called The League. Never mind. Her coalition partners will be Bunga Bunga himself, Silvio Berlusconi.
Wait, can I jump for a second? Who is Bunga Bunga?
Berlusconi is famous for various reasons, including that he used to have these Bunga Bunga parties, which were just like huge parties at his mansions with like ladies and drugs. And there's even a podcast called Bunga Bunga, which is all about the drama behind his like prime ministership.
Wow. Thank you for the clarification.
Well, I also wanted to add an important point that mm-hmm. he has had some plastic surgery.
Very important.
He has microblading on those brows. Mm-hmm. He's got hair plugs. He looks like he's made out of wax. But I'm not someone to disparage someone for their looks unless they're evil.
If you had the money, Jill, I'm sure you'd look exactly the same.
Giulio Berlusconi. Her other coalition partner is Matteo Salvini of The League, who in 2018 called for a mass cleansing of immigrants.
What?
Both Berlusconi and Salvini are huge supporters of Putin in the war of Ukraine. And, you know, Meloni has gone back and forth on the war in Ukraine. While she has said that she doesn't support it sometimes, she has, however, echoed some of Putin's, like, propaganda and anti-sanction rhetoric. A lot of people, interestingly, are very worried about how this will affect the Europeans' united front against Russia. Italy is one of the biggest economies in the Eurozone, so they could have a huge voice of dissension when it comes to enacting economic sanctions and other repercussions against Russia.
This is terrifying.
I told you, I did not warn you.
You did not warn me.
Meloni, who is originally from Rome, it goes without saying, is very conservative. She is anti-LGBTQ. She has said that she wants to challenge gay marriage in Italy, which was only legalized in 2016. And she calls abortion a tragedy. So many are worried about how her time as prime minister will affect women's rights in the country. She's also a proponent of the Great Replacement Theory and thinks that George Soros finances global mass immigration. It's giving QAnon.
The Great Replacement Theory being they will not replace us?
Literally.
Where's the pull eject? Is there a do we have one in this room? Can I just leave?
Busting out the wall.
Bye.
Now, Meloni's rise to power follows the trends of other European countries' far-right politicians gaining power as well. She's a friend and fan of far-right authoritarian Viktor Orban of Hungary, who we've talked about in previous mm-hmm. URSA episodes. He even congratulated her on her win. He said, "You go, girl."
God.
As well as the Sweden Democrats, which is a party with neo-Nazi roots. And the far-right Marine Le Pen of France is more popular than ever, and she's also a woman. And I guess it always, like, flummoxes me when, to put it simply, like, women politicians who are very conservative vote against their own interests.
Yeah.
And I found an article in The Atlantic by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who put it perfectly. She said that both Meloni and Le Pen are examples of what political scientists call gender washing. When female politicians adopt a non-threatening image to blunt the force of their extremism. Meloni's signature look involves flowing outfits and pastel shades. Isn't that also our
that
like
is
signature thing?
That's our signature right now.
Check out our new website.
Oh my God.
To uninformed foreigners, her ascent could look like female empowerment.
Yeah.
She poses as a defender of women, even as her party has rolled back women's rights.
It's terrifying. I was looking at some pictures of her, and she really does. She's got the, like, the bright pink suit. She's got, mm-hmm. she's quite small as well. She's, like, quite petite and looks like it could be, like, your best friend's mom.
Yes.
You know, that the lady who brings you snacks when you go over and visit. She definitely has that air about her. There's photos of her, like, holding little girls' faces.
Mm-hmm.
Is she whispering to them that they
those snacks are poisoned.
Okay.
And lastly, I wanted to add my favorite Meloni fact, of which there's only one. She is obsessed with J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings series.
What?
Yeah, which apparently has often been admired by Italian fascists, like, as a biblical text. And you're asking why.
I am. Yeah, my face is asking why.
For example, the orcs represent foreign invaders, and the Shire itself represents, you know, this perfect homeland that must be protected from the decadence of modernity. Side note, Tolkien is always...
Are the elves the decadence? I'm confused.
Hobbits? I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know anything about Lord of the Rings. Orlando Bloom. Side note, Tolkien had always said that his books had no political bias.
Okay, good. I mean, he should say that.
And young Italian neo-fascists have historically been so obsessed with the Lord of the Rings that they created hobbit camps in the 19th century.
Piss off, really?
Yes. These, like, hobbit camps kind of originated just as a place for young people who are also obsessed to
geek out.
To geek out.
Which is totally fine.
We love dorks.
Geek out over your Lord of the Rings. Do that.
But it very quickly turned into a kind of fascist Woodstock, and those camps ended in 1981.
What?
But that doesn't mean that, like, those stories aren't still popular.
Yeah.
Maloney attended a neo-fascist Hobbit 93 rally in Rome in 1993 when she was 16. She was also a fan of the band called Compagnia del Anello, or the Company of the Rings, who composed in 1977 one of the most popular songs for Italian neo-fascist youth, Il domani appartiente a noi.
Love your Italian.
Tomorrow belongs to us. In her early 20s, Maloney had the screen name Kyrie, the dragon of the internet.
You know what? Like, I feel bad for laughing because, you know, go off, like, fans of Lord of the Rings. But when you evolve into this toxic human being, I will laugh all I want.
Exactly. In an interview with the New York Times, she said, I think Tolkien could define the values of the conservative camp better than we do. And that's my breakdown of Miss Georgia Maloney.
Oh my God.
Kyrie, the dragon of the internet herself.
Wow.
My sources today were an Atlantic article by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a New York Times article by Jason Horowitz, a Mother Jones article by Abigail Weinberg, a BBC article by Paul Kirby, and a CNN article.
Thank you for sharing that, and to all those people who shared that too. I'm just left shell-shocked. If I don't come back from South Africa, you know why.
Same girl.
Yeah. I guess then I'm pretty happy that it just so happens that most of my climate news is semi-positive.
Yay.
Climate news. My first story comes from Politico, and it is a continuation of a story that I shared last month. I don't know if you remember, there was the African Climate Summit. No one attended. Mm. Everyone was at brunch.
Yep.
That shit show. I think the only head of state there was the Dutch Prime Minister.
Lovely.
Love that. Well, in some good news off of that, Denmark has become the first UN member to offer direct cash for communities affected by climate change. So I don't know if you remember, the conversation was reparations need to be made. Who's going to make them? Are they going to make them? And people weren't even showing up. So were they actually even going to provide money?
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't much, to be honest. It was only $13.3 million.
That's like my yearly income.
Yeah, that's really not a lot. But it has opened up what was once something that Europe just didn't do. We weren't fixing things, right?
There was no conversation around it either.
And the why, and just to be the annoying devil's advocate here, you can understand that the worry is that when you finally admit fault and you actually pay money, you are then admitting to fault for as long as it's been going on, which means that if they do admit to it, it sets them up to what is basically limitless legal liability for climate damage caused by emissions dating back to the Industrial Revolution.
Which, I'm down.
Yeah, at least I'll speak for ourselves. We know that this should happen and we want it to happen. So even though the cash was, and I quote from this article, a pittance, because we're pretty much causing like tens of billions of dollars worth of damage, Denmark's move was, and this is a quote from Alden Meyer, he's the US lead for International Climate Politics Hub. He says the move was important symbolically because it was sort of the breaking of the dam. Because when one UN member state is like, guys, we fucked up, we got to pay some money, the rest have to follow suit. It puts pressure even on the US, who are responsible for a quarter of the additional carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution, and the EU, who is responsible for over a fifth of the extra CO2.
Great.
It's hopeful, and I know how these things go, and I don't want to get too excited about it, but I'm glad to see that something came of that conference.
Definitely.
Then for my next story, we just quickly hop over to the Netherlands, speaking about CO2, because there is a city there called Haarlem that is currently banning all meat advertisements in public spaces.
Amazing.
So the hope is that this is going to be enforced by 2024, and it aims to reduce meat consumption and its impacts on the climate crisis.
That's so innovative.
Right? Pretty smart. So it follows similar prohibitions by other Dutch cities. I think they've banned advertising for fossil fuels, which seems pretty obvious to me. And also aviation companies are not allowed to publicly advertise anymore. And the councillor for the GroenLinks party, which, if you haven't figured that out, it's the Green Left party, which is the one that introduced the motion. Her name is Ziggy Klazes, which I just made me so happy when I read that, did clarify that the ban is only intended for some types of meat, just meat that comes from big meat industries and industrial farming.
Big meat.
Big meat. Yeah. I was reading that and I was just like, it's not going to matter to Jill. Jill doesn't need an advert to know that there's a steak around the corner.
I'm always looking.
Always looking for a steak. But yeah, I think that's a really, it's a hyper-specific way to go about it. And hopefully it makes some sort of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe to end on some happier Italian news.
There's so much happy news coming from you, Julia.
You're welcome.
Yay.
Yay. Italian researchers have built the first hydrogen-powered house in Europe. I need to clarify that because some people in my life felt the need to tell me that it exists in Australia already.
Oh,
so Australians, calm down.
All right.
This is the first in Europe. And essentially, with the energy crisis and climate change, these European institutions are trying to find ways to reduce fossil fuels and CO2 emissions. So researchers at this university, it's the University of San Nino in southern Italy, have come up with their solution, which is creating like a student house share that doubles as a science experiment.
Whoa.
And basically, this is a real life experiment that is currently fully powered by hydrogen. So there are these fuel cells fully powered by hydrogen, and they generate electricity and heating to meet the building's needs. And that's not all. The building also produces renewable energy from solar and geothermal sources.
That's so crazy. I want to see what it looks like.
How cool is that? So yeah, they've got a big sign up front that says hydrogen zero emission building. Very proud of it.
Cool.
Very happy with themselves. And I'm very proud of them too. So
come through, good climate news.
Yeah.
Hello, listener. IRSA is only made possible with the help of you, our patrons. Well, right now it's just us.
Yeah.
But you could become a patron.
Yes, you could. You could support us at patreon.com/IRSAPodcast. All we're asking for is the price of a cup of coffee or a really fancy croissant if you go somewhere special. And that then brings you the content that you love every month. And that money goes towards all the research that we do, our writing, our editing, and will also allow us to pay the incredible contributors who make IRSA what it is every single month.
So if you're enjoying IRSA and want to hear more, then please consider donating to our Patreon. Again, that's patreon.com/IRSAPodcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our first story takes us to a country that IRSA has yet to visit, Bulgaria.
About time.
The piece you're about to hear takes us to the windy peak of Buzucha, where we come face to face with the memorial house of the Bulgarian Communist Party and one woman's drive to preserve its history. Take a listen.
In the middle of Bulgaria, high in the Balkan mountain, on top of a windy peak called Buzucha, lies the colossal concrete skeleton of the memorial house of the Bulgarian Communist Party. This impressive structure looks like it came right out of a science fiction novel. In fact, I stopped one kid that was going around the monument with his parents, and when I asked him what the building reminded him of, he said, "It looks like a spaceship." But you don't need to be a 10-year-old boy to make the connection. The memorial house is a huge round building, 60 meters in diameter. There are panoramic windows around the periphery of the building, 8 meters long, 2 meters high, looking at the surrounding mountain chain to the east and west, and at the Danubian plain to the north, and the Thracian valley to the south. Right next to the main building stands an imposing 70-meter-high tower with a ruby-red pentagram on top, like a gigantic communistic flag proudly waving in the Balkan wind. Yet all former glory and glamour the monument on Peak Buzuja used to have died along with communism. Now the artificial ruby the Red Star was made out of is broken and only a few pieces remain in place. The windows of the building are completely gone, and if you look further up, you will see that there are big holes in the copper roof of the flying saucer. So it is left open to the elements, and nature is getting back in. Hundreds of swallows have decided that this is the perfect place to make their nests. I'm standing in front of the main entrance, recording the swallows flying in and out of their shelter. And then I turn around and I see a young woman with a big smile on her face and a yellow construction helmet on her head. She's walking toward me and waving.
My name is Dora Ivanova. I'm an architect and I'm the founder and the coordinator of the Buzuja Project Foundation.
Dora studied architecture at the Technical University of Berlin. She grew up in Bulgaria in the 90s, and yet she only found out about the Buzuja monument during her studies in Germany. Dora was fascinated by the unique building, and she was also bewildered by its current state. So she made it her goal to make this abandoned place a vibrant space for culture and education. In 2014, she wrote her master thesis about the building, and in 2015, she moved back to Bulgaria and founded the Buzuja Project Foundation.
Yeah, this is my 24/7 job. It's not 9-to-5 job, because it's I don't understand it as a job. It is a cause. I'm involved from the moment I open my eyes until I close my eyes in the evening, and it is just a very strong motivator for me. And obviously for many other people, because in the team there are more than 100 experts who worked on a conservation management plan. We have experts from Spain, from the UK, from Greece, from Canada even. But of course, most of the team are from Bulgarians.
I am meeting Dora on this sunny day in July, so she can show me around and tell me a bit about how the preservation work is going. I have seen many photos of the interior of the building, yet when we step inside, everything looks very different than what I imagined. To be honest, I'm surprised here in the entrance hall, it looks very dark. I suppose it was very well lit when it used to function, but right now it seems a bit, yeah, like a cave almost.
Yes, we are under the flying saucer.
Right.
And there were lights, which were exactly circular lights in a circle under the flying saucer, which again expressed exactly this feeling of this out of space world or place. And now, as the lights are not there anymore, yes, it's dark and cold also.
Yes, it is. Standing here, my arms immediately get covered by goosebumps. But it's not only because of the cold. I have to admit, I might have an ulterior motive for this interview. You see, I was born and raised in the nearby town of Stara Zagora, so I've spent the first 19 years of my life about an hour away from Buzuja. But I never got the chance to get inside. So this is a very exciting opportunity for me.
Sure, it's a unique opportunity because the building is close to the public, as it is still dangerous for visitors. And our work right now is concentrated exactly on that, to secure it, to make it safe, so that we can open it to the visitors also in this condition.
Shall we go further?
Yeah, let's go.
Up the stairs, we reach the main hall. And I feel like I'm standing in the middle of an abandoned space cathedral. Around 15 meters above us, the sun is coming through the giant holes in the roof. It is very peaceful in here. the only sounds are coming from the swallows and from the restorators who are working on a scaffolding which goes all the way up to the ceiling. By the way, Dora lovingly calls them my restorators, which I think is very sweet.
When you stand in this main hall, knowing how it looked back in the day and seeing how it looks right now, how do you feel? What do you think about when you're here?
I see the future when I'm here. I see how we clean up the space. I see how we make it accessible. And then how more and more people get interested and involved in this place. How people come here to learn about the past, but also to experience art. So I can imagine here different installations, new and very flexible functions. I can see here concerts and a lot of music. And I see that this place will really have the potential to draw interest to Bulgaria, draw interest to this history that we need to know. And I think when this building is working, the entire area will benefit a lot. And Bulgaria will benefit a lot. So I see no reason why this shouldn't happen.
This place, it's so unique and it has been left alone to decay for tens of years. Why did you start this work? Why did you think that it is possible to make something out of it? And you say now you see the future when you stand here. Where does this optimism come from?
That's a complex question. So first of all, I'm an architect and I see that this is a unique piece and I can say masterpiece of architecture that we have in Bulgaria. One of the reasons we have to save it is because of that. And I'm also completely sure that we have to save it also because of the history and because we need this social dialogue about the difficult past. Another reason why I started with this project, mm-hmm. I guess it's living in Berlin for 10 years. I was part of the history of the place and the history of the city is very strong and very dissonant, very difficult, but it is presented in multiple places. And even if you're not interested specifically in some historical facts, they are mm-hmm. everywhere and you're exposed to them and you become more tolerant to different stories, and in this way you prevent also mistakes into the future. And looking back to Bulgaria and seeing how underrepresented the difficult past is, I think it's an absolutely logical decision for me to work into this direction.
Have you had to deal with some criticism about restoring a communistic monument?
Yes, of course. Because many people who don't know what is the philosophy of the project and what are the goals behind it would think that we want to save the place for glorifying communism. And this is absolutely not the goal of this project. We want to show the history and to preserve the place as a cultural heritage and to use it into the future. So once these people understand what we actually want to achieve with preserving Buzluja, then they also understand and support the project. But of course, many people don't look into the depth of what the goal is. Hello.
Hello.
As we are wrapping up the interview in the entrance hall, a guy in his late 50s is curiously looking at us through a hole in the front door.
Photo from the inside.
You would have to ask Dora.
Are you from Germany?
Yes.
This German tourist will have to wait, but not for very long. Dora is hoping to have the building secure and open for visitors in the spring of 2023. Until then, if you want to find out more about the Buzluja project and to learn how you can support the conservation work, you can check out their website, which you will find in the show notes of this episode. If you want to find out more about the history of this unique place, you would have to tune into the Ursa feed later this month, when we will publish the full version of this story. There's some very exciting stuff coming along. For Bear Radio from Bulgaria, I'm Milica Tekeljeva.
Up next, we get to share from the podcast Life of Bi. The episode is called Feral Girl Summer.
Woo,
just for clarification, that's like the hornier escalation of Hot Girl Summer. Because in 2021, that was Hot Girl Summer, but no one was allowed outside. So hot turned into feral.
Got it.
And in it, your hosts, Elle and Mary, explore how to honor your inner hot girl when you're in a long-term relationship. For the segment you're about to hear, they ask, can you be bisexual and monogamous? And they come across the answer in a slightly problematic and what feels like very dated online magazine.
I just want to say,
and it ain't over till the bisexual speaks.
Then I Googled, because I was thinking about this debate, this thing of can you be bi and monogamous? So I Googled essentially that, bisexual monogamy. And I found this Well and Good article that says 10 tips to explore your bisexuality in a monogamous relationship. I just really want to emphasize this title before I move on to list the points.
Yeah.
10 tips to explore your bisexuality in a monogamous relationship. Have you got that?
I've got that.
Step one.
Do we have an issue with that yet?
No.
Okay.
Step one, talk with your partner.
No. I won't do it.
Step two.
We've taken a monastic vow of silence in our relationship.
Step two, ask yourself how important it is to you to hook up with people of other genders.
It's a good question. It's a good question.
Step three, open your relationship.
How many steps are there in total?
10.
Where'd you go from there?
We were to explore bisexuality in a monogamous relationship, and the third step is open your relationship. I think that is fucking funny.
That's insane.
I burst into laughter and tried to tell you, and then you rightly told me not to tell you yet. Step four is learn more about LGBTQ history, which I think you've got covered.
I think we're doing that, yep.
Step five is make queer friends.
I hate them. No, I basically exclusively have queer friends.
Step six, this is my wording, masturbate furiously.
How did they put it?
Masturbate, masturbate, and masturbate some more.
Oh, fuck's sake.
Mine's better, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I do that.
Step seven.
Yeah.
Queer porn.
Well, yeah, hand in hand.
Not always.
Not always, actually. I'm quite into audio porn.
Well, that's step eight. Queer non-visual porn. I can't believe they even count as separate. They were clearly scraping the barrel here. I mean, if you have to list open your relationship in step three, you really aren't addressing the problem. Like, that would get you a fail if that was an essay.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Define your terms. Step nine, journaling. Step 10, chat rooms.
Chat rooms?
Now this, I think, is fascinating.
That's interesting.
It
That's
exposes
like dating apps.
So many contradictions in this person's understanding of monogamy or fidelity. Because like chat rooms, in some relationships, would be considered cheating.
Yeah,
obviously, it checks in. It says, you know, check in with your partner. But I'm like, that it does
Before you open your relationship.
That does not count as monogamy.
No.
Even watching porn.
It's
a subsection of what's allowed in monogamy. In a Western understanding, if you're monogamous for religious reasons, you're not watching porn. Your monogamy is meant to be like, well, you're not meant to be.
Do you think many people observe that properly?
It's just...
I get, well, maybe.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be seeking sexual pleasure of any kind outside of it.
Wow.
I would say, and like really, if we're talking about the whole spectrum of monogamy to
polyamory,
anarchic non-monogamy, then yeah. And we take into account like marriages based on religious
that's
grounds.
Like right down the end of one of the spectrum that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair point.
Anyway.
Wow, that was fascinating.
So then we get into this idea of like what we define as monogamy. Sex therapist Jessie Kahn says, you don't need to hook up with a bunch of people to explore your sexuality. You don't have to have experiences with anyone of any gender in order to confidently declare that you are bisexual or queer or pansexual.
Amen.
I'm going to be completely honest here and say that I don't feel fully amen about that. And I know I should.
Right, okay.
But I definitely, there's a bit of me my mate calls this lizard brain when you're thinking about like your ugly size.
Yep.
Where I'm like, no. But that is, I know, not the right opinion.
Yeah.
I know that's not inclusive.
Well, thanks for saying it because...
But I definitely have that because I'm like, well, you've talked about like your queer age being younger.
Yeah.
And that is based on like sexual or romantic experiences, isn't it? That's why you feel younger. Maybe not.
And it's also because I was older when I started. So like my coming out, I was 20. And so I've had 6 years of my life where I've been an out queer person.
Mm.
But I've had 20 extra years of not being an out queer person.
I'm the same though.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that. But you were also way more sexual. Like the beginning of my sexual experiences was only a year before I slept with a woman.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas you were sleeping with men for years before
yeah,
me.
Like yeah, like 5 years. So I always
really feel, cocked up that body
yeah, so
count.
I felt incredibly like sexually mature.
Yeah, yeah,
in
yeah.
In straight situations.
This makes loads of sense.
And I still feel like sexually pretty immature, especially 2.5 years into a relationship with a cis man. I still feel much less mature as a queer person sexually. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's where like
the age thing
my
comes
queer
in.
Yeah, my queer self feels like a teenager.
I think that's such a beautiful way of phrasing it as well. And I think loads of people listening to this will recognise that.
Yeah.
I think there's a reason we have this idea of the baby gay.
Yeah, totally. Which is why I think I feel amen to that statement.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think it's really important for anyone who's questioning themselves to feel like they're allowed to do that from, like, even within a relationship that is monogamous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man. I fully, fully agree with that. I think my...
I think it's really great and honest of you to have said, though, because I understand why you feel lizard brain...
Yeah, there's just a bit of me which is like resists it. But then I wholeheartedly agree with everything you just said.
I think it's okay to wholeheartedly agree with like an opinion and know.
No, but like, I spirit like, yeah. like I wholly, it's not, I don't have any lizard brain when you say that.
Great.
So I think when I think my lizard brain resistance is thinking about it life-wise.
Right.
Because I'm like, of course, you can say that at any point, but I think I would encourage people
to
explore
it
in real life or physically, not
sure.
In real life,
yeah.
But like have those experiences.
Sense.
It feels very important to me.
Mm.
And I'm also like, there are things about your queerness that will,
I totally.
But I'm also like cancelling out asexual people here.
It's okay. We can't be, I think this is a really important and like gritty conversation. And it's okay that we're not currently speaking for asexual people. And I think it's okay also to include this. like, oh my God.
We must.
Yeah.
But yes, from my own personal perspective and in my own life,
mm-hmm.
I have experienced so much personal growth from having sex that I'm like with other people or not even... You know, I'm not talking about sex in the broadest terms.
Yes, yeah.
Here, but like romantic or sexual or intimate experiences
mm-hmm.
that explore your queerness. I mean, they're so life. They can be life changing.
Absolutely. I mean, weirdly, this is going to sound like a non sequitur, but my sister's a PhD student, and she's giving a talk today about the fact that she speaks German fluently. and she didn't know how to conclude the talk. And I said, well, when you learnt German fluently as a second language, you had a whole new version of yourself that you could step into because you learnt that language as an adult. So you had almost a different personality that came with it.
It's the same as your queer German age.
And I think that... Yeah, I
forever
think
old.
It's important to it's important to explore your queerness because you might discover a really different part of yourself, a like different facet of your personality.
Yeah.
It might unlock you in ways like creatively and you know, yeah.
And on that, I'm just going to add one more thing then we really will move on.
Mm-hmm.
Is that again, to nuance further my argument on this, is I do think that it is possible to have the broadest, most curious, queer, explorative sexual experiences with a single person. Like, there's nothing actually in the way of exploring all of that with one person.
So even though we laugh at like that first step of that article, which is speaking to your partner, I think that regardless of the gender or the sexuality of your partner, you can explore queer forms of sex with them.
Yeah, of course.
And like, that doesn't have to happen outside of the relationship. It can if it's agreed.
Yeah.
But yeah, the possibilities are endless.
Are fucking endless, particularly if you're not genital centric.
Mm.
And you think more about how it feels, or you can use other different parts of the body as the erogenous zones, you know?
For the full episode, head to Life of Bi on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and go and show them support for their incredible work on their Patreon. It's patreon.com/lifeofbi. And you can also follow Elle and Mary on Instagram at Hotter Project. We're so happy to be joined again by Jane Silva of Expo Lina. Jane is also coming to us from her home studio, where you've got a little pup running around in the background, and we've got little Miss Miko, our office dog, with us here as well. So if anybody hears a little
pitter patter
or doggy conversation between the screen, you know why.
It's a very dog happy day.
It is. So what are you here to talk to us about today?
Yeah, I'm here to talk about what might be one of the most talked about restaurant openings of 2022 in Berlin and my take on it, and also what this particular type of restaurant means for Berlin and others like it, as well as a very exciting Turkish street food discovery.
Ooh. All very intriguing. So are you allowed to tell us what this restaurant is?
Yeah, so the restaurant is called Cocodrillo, and it's kind of blown up Instagram over the past few months. I mean, I guess it depends on which Instagrams you follow. But anyone with the slightest interest in food has heard about this place, just because they're huge, they're flashy, and they're part of this giant French restaurant group that this is their first restaurant in Berlin. And so basically they opened at this huge building that used to be called Nolles am Weinberg. It was this kind of like spiesig Austrian Swiss fondue type restaurant. It got taken over by this restaurant group. They have either millionaire or billionaire investors, and they have at least like a dozen restaurants all over Europe. And their whole concept is they have these Italian trattorias, but with this almost kind of Instagram theme park vibe. So the one in Berlin, if you've seen anything on Instagram, it's just this super red interior. Like, it's this deep red. There's like neon signs and posters and like cocktail mugs with boobs on them. And basically everywhere you look, there's something. It's just this like constant amusement park vibe for adults.
Is this a common thing to have like a concept for your restaurant? And can you maybe dive into what the actual concept is for this one?
I guess concept is a very loose thing, but this whole restaurant group, like each of their restaurants have this very similar vibe. Like, it's all about creating a vibe, which is, I guess, sexy Italo disco, but mostly just like Instagram bait. Like, it's really like everywhere you look in this restaurant, there's like something you can take a photo of. They have a fake library, and like this, the experience of going to the bathroom even is like this whole thing where you go like down a rabbit hole, and there's one-way mirrors in the bathroom doors.
Whoa.
So that you can see other people washing their hands while you pee.
No.
Sketchy.
It's the weirdest thing. Like, it took me a while to be able to pee just because I'm like, can they see me?
Yeah.
And also, like, with the whole concept restaurant idea, does that take away at all from the quality of the food?
I was going to say, because some of these Instagram places have terrible food.
So the good news about this place is the food is not bad. Like,
good to know.
The signature dish is this truffle pasta, and it's honestly really good. They put a ton of truffles in it. I guess being this millionaire restaurant group means that they can actually like splurge on the food a little bit. And it's 19 euros, which is not terrible for this giant bowl of pasta and cheese and truffles. And yeah, they have pizza. The pizza is, you know, more or less on par with what's being served at most pizza places in Berlin right now. You know, it's not like anything that'll blow your mind, but like, I think the main purpose of the food is to just like be a sideshow to the vibe. Like, you don't come here specifically for the food. You really just come here for the whole vibe.
The experience. Are there any others like it in the city?
So the one that comes to mind is Frederick's, which opened this year. And I haven't actually been there yet, but this is right by the Sony Center. It's this, again, like a huge place that there are the remains of this old hotel from like the Weimar era where like Charlie Chaplin used to stay.
Wow.
They also have crazy looking cocktail vessels. I think that's one through line between these places as well, is that when you order cocktails, you get them served in something whimsical and unexpected.
Mm.
So there it's like skull mugs and seashells from the looks of it.
Why?
Is it underwater?
Like,
themed?
How is that Weimar?
No.
I don't understand. I'm very intrigued by it. It's just people, a lot of money and a lot of creative energy that is just chaotic. And their respective partners were like, you need to take this out of the house. And so they put it in a restaurant.
Basically, yeah. I mean, they also have a cocktail menu where you can choose your drink based on like a color palette.
Okay.
You mentioned up top that you had an interesting Turkish street food for us. Do we want to get into that?
We can get into the street food.
Yes, please.
So yeah, this is one of my favorite discoveries lately. So there's this Turkish restaurant called Mardin that is on Kaposerdam, so just north of Hermannplatz. And earlier this year, they set up this street stand selling only Turkish stuffed mussels, so midye dolma.
Whoa.
And so these are mussels that have been filled with this kind of spiced rice mixture and then steamed in their own shells. They're super good and you can get them. I mean, they're basically a euro each. You can get 10 for 10 euros and it's...
I have a question just about the restaurant itself. Is that one that you're a fan of and would recommend?
Yeah, the restaurant is also, I mean, it's a like Turkish grill restaurant, and they've also not been open for terribly long, maybe a year and a half or something like that. They're run by people from Mardin in Turkey. You know, a lot of Turkish restaurants in Berlin are run by Turkish Germans,
mm-hmm.
but basically I think they came straight from Turkey to open this restaurant possibly like quite recently.
Very cool.
So, and yeah, I mean, they have a lot of grilled meat things. They have really good lahmacun if you're into that. But I think my favorite thing there is still the mussels, because also there's just nowhere else in Berlin that you can find these. In Istanbul, they're this super popular street food specialty. But yeah, these are the first people doing it in Berlin.
I mean, my question is not unrelated and I don't want to throw you, but I mean, it's related to Turkish food. My boyfriend's family is visiting, and one of the things that they had really requested was to have Turkish food. So already, this is a really good piece of advice. But the other question was, they're huge fans of baklava and stuff.
Mm.
And I never know which sweet shop to go to, because some of them are really good and some of them use like peanuts instead of pistachios. And I was wondering if you had any advice on that.
I do.
You do?
The best baklava in Berlin is the place that I used to live above. So I'm not biased at all, but literally it is the best baklava in Berlin. It's called Konditorei Damaskus.
Okay.
And it's run by a Syrian family that came here as refugees, but they used to run a baklava shop in Homs, and you're just not going to get better baklava and other baklava adjacent Syrian sweets than this.
Where is it? Tell us where you used to live.
It's Zonin Alley 93.
Let's freaking go.
We're so close.
Julie and I must leave immediately.
Goodbye.
Yeah. But they now, I think they've gotten so popular because of their amazing baklava that they have a few outposts now. So they, I think there's one in Moabit.
Okay.
And they maybe even have two shops on Zonin Alley that I saw.
Cool. Well,
okay. That was very helpful. Thank you very much. I feel like ending on a dessert is perfect for me.
Me
on
too.
A sweet note.
Yeah, exactly.
My stomach is about to growl. Well, as usual, thank you so much, Jane. Julie and I are going to go get some snacks.
Mm-hmm.
And we will talk to you next month.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Julie and I are currently in the cutest little blanket fort that she made.
I made it.
And we have Johnny on Zoom with us. We can see his beautiful face. He has his dogs at home who are apparently making lots of noise. But we're here for the culture section of URSA. Johnny, how are you?
I'm doing good, yeah. I mean, I don't have a blanket fort. I really wish I'd have known in advance.
We'll organize that for next month. I'll come over and build you one.
Brilliant, I'm in.
What have you been up to, Johnny?
Well, so obviously Berlin Art Week happened between the 14th and the 18th of September. And I went to this really cool event. So what I've realized is if you want me to like something more, you just have to gamify it. But there was an exhibition happening called Machines versus Human Art at Pop Kudam. And Pop Kudam is a relatively new art and cultural center on Kudam. It's from the same people who did Platoon Kunsthalle. Anyway, so it's the people who are behind that are now behind this new place. And the exhibition was Machines versus Human Art. And there were basically 30 digital screens with different artworks on them. And then so you can appreciate them in and of themselves. But also you get a little card when you go in and you have to guess which of the art pieces were made by humans and which were made by AI.
Whoa.
So not only do you get like the enjoyment of seeing the art and, you know, appreciating it, you also get this extra gamified element where you're like, is it AI? Is it human? And it's very hard to tell. And yeah, so that was super cool. Got very competitive, did very well, of course. And then there was another part of the exhibition upstairs, which I found really interesting as well, which was using, you know, the DALL-E software where you input prompts to the AI software and it generates images based on what you've put in. And it was highlighting the ways in which there's inherent biases in the technology. The image generator, because it's pulling from what's already existing on the internet, it does stuff which is biased and gendered and makes all these other mistakes. And I just thought that was also very interesting.
Yeah,
great exhibition. Loved it.
Cool. So what is coming up this month?
Following on from Berlin Art Week, an exhibition that started as part of Berlin Art Week is at CO Berlin, the photography gallery. And they're doing an exhibition which is Queerness in Photography. It's actually three different exhibitions under the same banner. One is Undercover, A Secret History of Crossdressers. And this is the photographs from a curator collector, Sebastian Lifshitz. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but that's what we're going with. But what they've done is they've found these historical photographs. They have photographs dating back to the 1860s, and it's all about people who've been using photography to question their gender. But the thing is, obviously, they don't know the motivations of the people who are behind these photographs or what inspired them, but they've all been curated and they're all expressing the same kind of thing. So that's one of them. There's also Casa Susana, which is the Cindy Sherman collection, which is photographs of crossdressers and trans women from Hunter in New York. And this is a community that provided a safe space for trans and cross-dressing people. And then the last one is Orlando, and that's curated by Tilda Swinton.
Tilda Swinton?
Is there another Tilda Swinton? Yeah, so because she played the gender non-conforming lead role in the film Orlando, then she was asked to curate this exhibition. So some of the photography was made especially for this show. Other ones are from other places. And yeah, again, it's another examination of queerness in photography.
And what are the dates of that exhibition?
That is running from right now up until, I think it's in the January the 18th. So up until next year. So you've got some time to see that.
Cool. Then what else is coming up after that?
I don't know if you guys know Club Gretchen.
Yes.
For those who don't know, it specializes in hip hop, beats, drum and bass, all these kinds of genres. It's the Berlin home for that kind of thing. They are celebrating their 11th year anniversary. And as part of that, they have DJ Crush doing his 30th anniversary tour. DJ Crush is a Japanese DJ, has been around for a very long time. And he's doing a show on the 7th, Friday the 7th of October. So he'll be playing like electronica, hip hop, funk. So that's, for me, it's a personal highlight because I'm just a long-term fan. Mm-hmm. It's the 11th year anniversary of Gretchen, but also 26 years of the seminal drum and bass record label Recycle and 12 years of Impulse. So they're doing a special drum and bass event on the Saturday, the 8th of October. And yeah, so if you're a drum and bass fan of any kind, or this is the number one place to go to, probably in Berlin for the whole year.
And you'll be there. So that's another highlight of that event.
Yeah, you get to see my face. I mean, that's worth the ticket price alone.
Am I right?
I think.
I'd say so.
Yeah, and then coming up next from the 7th of October to the 16th of October, we are going to be treated to another edition of the Berlin Festival of Lights. Have you guys been to the Festival of Lights before?
Yeah.
I've been to a couple.
For those people that don't know, the Berlin Festival of Lights essentially is where they will illuminate with special projections and projection mapping different buildings throughout the city and different landmarks. So the Brandenburger Tor, lots of the buildings on the museum, Insel, things at Potsdamer Platz, these are all especially illuminated. So you get a map and then you can just go from place to place. It's super cool. I mean, I don't know if they do this in other cities, but they don't do it where I'm from. So the fact that that happens here and I experience it here always gives me one of those feelings when I'm there where I'm like, I love Berlin. I love that people of all ages, from tiny kids to like the elderly, are all out together doing the same thing and appreciating the same thing. And obviously in their own way.
It's very cute. Then what else is happening?
Okay, so some more club news. I don't know if you guys remember Chalet, the club. It was a really popular Berlin club on Schlesische Straße. It closed down a few years ago, pre-pandemic. And what had opened up beside it has been a club called Eden. So Chalet is being reopened as Eve. So you've got Eden and Eve. Then there's also this club night called Lunchbox Candy. Here's like a safe, queer, sex-positive club night. And it is run by El Nino Diablo and Adam Munnings. And it's just established a really great reputation in a very short space of time for doing really high quality, super fun, super good parties. I'm really happy to see it back. Chalet was a place where I just always ended up on many nights out, and it was very sad that it was gone. I'm really looking forward to seeing what the people that own Eden, to see what they've done with the new club. So there's no better way to check that out also than by going to Lunchbox Candy's first birthday. It's going to be awesome. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to rock on to the next one.
Yes, please.
So to finish off, we're going to actually have two like art, multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary festivals. The last two things I'm going to talk about. The first one is 3HD. So 3HD is the festival that comes from the Cream Cake Collective. Cream Cake are, yeah, super cool. I'm going to just read how they describe themselves because they describe themselves perfectly in a way that I don't want to have to try and match up to. So they say they're a Berlin-based interdisciplinary platform negotiating the point of convergence in electronic music, contemporary art, and digital technologies. Distance from normative social structures, Cream Cake moves in fluid processes of thought and action and engages with current social issues of the present through diverse projects. And 3HD is the festival that this collective produces. And the new festival this year, it's Life, the Universe, and Everything. So they've taken the phrase from Douglas Adams' book / radio show, actually, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So that's,
When is this festival on?
This is from October the 20th to the October 29th. And it's going to be, they have like installations, DJs, music, all kinds of different, I suppose, collisions between these different art forms. And it also takes place at some really amazing venues. So it takes place at Habalam Ufa, Berlinische Gallery, also in Ulm, the Grand Planetarium, Trauma Bar and Kino. So it's a lot of the best venues in the city are hosting events that are part of the festival.
And what was the other festival that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, the last one is another interdisciplinary festival. It's called Signals Festival, and it is going to be happening in Funk House from the 28th to the 29th of October. It's over 2 days. It's emerging and diverse creative communities with live performances, installations, film screenings, workshops, and in-depth dialogue. And the thing about this festival as well is they aim to have a very fair ticket price. It's run by a not-for-profit organization, so it's a very inclusive environment. And it's aiming to get as many people engaged in the different art forms as possible. And for them, I suppose the strap line for the festival is the perfect curated you. And what is more real? Our online or offline selves? Do digital realms distort who we are? Or do they offer space for truer expression? How do we live and coexist in the evolving world of the multi-self? So again, you know, it's another examination of how technology is impacting who we are as people and how we experience the world. I think this one probably is might be a little bit more introspective than the 3HD festival is. I think the 3HD will probably be more outward looking. I feel like, yeah, the Signals festivals might be more inward looking. And there's going to be lots of discussions and talks about this as well.
I'm excited.
Me too. Cool. Thank you so much, Johnny.
Thanks.
Do you want to do one plug for the Lola Club?
Yeah. I mean, very quickly, everybody should, if you've enjoyed what I've been talking about here, you should go to lolamag.de, because then we also create other events and activities throughout the Berlin, just like this. And if you become a member of Lola, you can get better rates for the events and activities that we have curated, and as well as like just learning more about the wild and interesting city in which we live. And then follow us on Instagram.
Of course. Well, then thank you so much, Johnny, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks. Ciao.
Bye.
Andreas Miranda is an Austro-Belgian multi-instrumentalist composer based in Berlin. His work has been played and performed all over the world. And here's an original piece he kindly shared with us for IRSA. If you would like to hear more of Andreas's work, head over to his website, andreasmiranda.com.
Thank you to Melitza Tekalieva, El Potter, and Mary Higgins for sharing their incredible work with IRSA this month.
Thank you as well to our regular correspondents, Jane Silver and Johnny Tiernan. You can stay up to date by heading to Ex Berliner and Lola.
The next episode of IRSA lands November 1st.
Yay! IRSA was produced, written, and edited by us, Julia Joubert and Jill Baton. Special thanks goes to our IRSA maestro, Lucas Carey, for making all of our music.
That's the sound of a Patreon plug.
Ooh.
Support for this podcast comes from our Patreon. I know you like IRSA. You're back again. So if you do like it, show us. And show all the incredible stories as well how much you love them by considering supporting us at patreon.com/IRSAPodcast.
It's the price you would spend on a flat white in Kreuzberg, or a tenth of the price nowadays that you would spend getting into a Berlin club that you don't even like the music of. And this would go back to supporting us and our contributors each month for all of the hard work that goes into bringing you this very show.
And we'd even thank you on top of it. So from a shout out at the top of next month's episode to collaborating with us on stories or topics you think that we should cover, we do consider you part of the IRSA family, and we couldn't do it without you. So it is patreon.com/ us a podcast, and we thank you in advance.
And lastly, one thing, if you're a producer who makes stories about Europe and you would like to be featured in an upcoming episode of URSA, reach out to info@bearradio.org. Till then, we're Jill and Julia.
Peace.
Can we keep that?
Yeah. Oh, peace. That's a Lord of the Rings reference.
Orlando Bloom.